From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 13 GOP senators write a new health bill behind closed doors, leaving everyone else to wonder what's in it.
It's not about me not knowing. It's about the people of Michigan not knowing. If somebody has cancer and they're going to lose their treatments, they have a right to know what's in this bill.
A retired Michigan high school teacher will get the Medal of Honor for his courage as a Vietnam War combat medic, rescuing comrades even though he was wounded.
I would rather be dead than to have gotten on that helicopter and found out later on that someone else got killed because their medic wasn't there for them. That was my job.
Plus, beards, baseball, and religion, the House of David.
They had a belief system that sort of goes with the Book of Revelations, that the end of days is coming, and therefore you should live your life as cleanly and well as possible.
And now the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A group of 13 Republican senators continue to work in secrecy, writing a bill to replace the Affordable Care Act. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is leading the group. He says Republicans will see a discussion draft of the bill tomorrow. The goal? A vote 1 week from tomorrow, June 29th. With that in mind, consider this.
This massive piece of legislation that seeks to restructure one-sixth of our economy is being written behind closed doors without input from anyone in an effort to jam it past the, not only the Senate but the American people, an artificial deadline. Every American will be affected by this missing bill. Every single American will be affected by this, and no one will have had an opportunity to read it and to understand it.
And that was Senator Mitch McConnell in 2009 as the Affordable Care Act was being drawn up. Even today, other GOP senators are complaining about the secrecy that he is imposing on this process. Here with us now, Michigan's Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. Welcome, Senator.
Well, it's good to be with you.
As you hear Mitch McConnell in 2009, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Cynthia, there's two things I would say. First of all, when he was saying that back in 2009, it actually wasn't accurate. I sat on the Finance Committee. Between the two committees working on this, we had 100 hearings and committee meetings, 100. And we spent 18 months writing the bill, 25 days, I think, in total, on the floor of the U.S. Senate. So, first of all, that was not accurate. Today, though, his words would be very true. I sit on the Finance Committee. We're not holding any hearings. I head the Health Subcommittee of Finance as the lead Democrat. I've not seen the bill. No one's talked to me about it. We have no information other than what we're getting in bits and pieces from other people. Ironically, I get the information from lobbyists. That's who knows more about it than we do. And the important thing for me, it's not about me not knowing. It's about the people of Michigan not knowing. If somebody has cancer and they're going to lose their treatments, they have a right to know what's in this bill and give their views. If somebody's got a mom with Alzheimer's, they're going to lose their nursing home care. They have a right to know what's in this bill. And so healthcare is not political. It's personal for each and every one of us and our families. And it's stunning to me the way they are trying to ram this through.
We know that you and the other Democratic senators are vowing to fight this or to get a voice in this. You indeed were part of the Democratic talk-a-thon Monday night on the Senate floor. But for all the talk of fight, Senator, what can the Democratic caucus truly do against this GOP majority?
Well, we have voices. We can encourage people to be engaged. They tried to do this way back in January 27th. That's when they originally wanted to do it, because of women's marches and healthcare marches and people engaging and speaking out. It is now in June, and they still have not accomplished it. So that is important. But in the end, the bottom line is three Republican colleagues have to say no to this. That's the bottom line. They have the votes if they have 51 people who want to vote for this. And so I know that people in a number of states around the country are laser focused on their senators who could be the deciding vote. And that's ultimately what has to happen.
When you look at your Republican colleagues in the Senate, do you look around? Do you see three possible, candidates to defeat this bill, to break party ranks?
I do. I mean, there's no question that I have Republican colleagues that know this is bad. But in fact, ironically, the President of the United States said to the Senate Republicans last week that the House bill was mean after he celebrated it in the Rose Garden with the Republican caucus and so on. He now says it's mean.
Which it makes everybody mean. Wonder what kind of direction can anyone take in crafting something when you see that.
You know what really needs to happen? They need to stop what is a political exercise and instead reach out and work with us on the real issues around health care, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, bringing down out-of-pocket costs. There's still too many families paying too high of a co-pays and premiums. In this current insurance pool model, there's not enough insurance companies, so there's not enough competition to bring down costs. Let's focus on that. Let's focus on other ways to make health care better. That's what we should be doing. And let me stress also, Michigan is the case study for how focusing on health care and getting people, giving them an opportunity to see a doctor and get preventative care works and saves money for taxpayers. The governor, the legislature did the right thing, created Healthy Michigan, expanded Medicaid. What happened after that? Well, 97% of Michigan children can now see a doctor. We have 50% fewer people walking into an emergency room to get their care because they can't see a doctor and don't have health insurance. And the bottom line is the state of Michigan, Michigan taxpayers are going to save $432 million next year in savings on health care costs they don't have to pay because people can go to a doctor and they can get preventative care rather than getting really sick and ending up in the most expensive way to get health care, which is the emergency room. So those are the facts. And that's a reason why we need to continue, build on what's working and fix the problems.
Let's talk about political calculus in all of this. We know the much-watched special election in Georgia to replace Congressman Tom Price was seen as a referendum on President Trump. There were a lot of Democratic hopes riding on that, yet Democrat John Ossoff lost. Do you think this could impact the momentum the GOP has in this health care bill?
Well, first of all, that's a Republican district. And we all had high hopes on that race. I think if John Ossoff had been able to run a local race without it becoming a national referendum, it actually would have been better for him because it's a local district, it's a Republican area. He needed to have Republican support as well as independents, and he was in a very tough atmosphere and still almost won. So, yeah, I give him a lot of credit for that. But I think going forward, what we're going to see is the real referendum in 2018, and we're going to see what happens if they rip health care apart and take it away from tens of millions of people and raise everybody else's health care costs and take that money and give it to another tax cut for the wealthiest people in the country. I think there are going to be a lot of extremely unhappy people.
All right, let's talk about what you see amongst your Republican colleagues. Thinking, for example, going back to 2009 as the Affordable Care Act was being written, let's take a quick listen to Senator John McCain in 2009.
We want to sit down. We want to do what the president pledged that he would do. We want to sit down and negotiate. We want the C-SPAN cameras in the room. We want to do something which is bipartisan, which is good for America.
And now this morning, Senator McCain is on the morning cable shows complaining he's in the dark about this bill that Majority Leader McConnell and his group are writing. What kinds of dissension are you seeing, and where could this go with your Republican colleagues?
Well, Republican colleagues say they're very frustrated, and I hope that means they'll go to their leader and say, stop this secret process jamming a bill through that affects what is now one-fifth of the economy and affects every single one of us in either our health care costs as well as our coverage. They should say, stop this. I do need to go back, though, to 2009 again, because there were all kinds of efforts to negotiate in a bipartisan way. In fact, we included 147 Republican amendments in the final bill in an effort to reach out across the aisle and have a bipartisan effort, which is always better. It's always better to get a bipartisan bill. But at the time, Mitch McConnell was very strategic in wanting to have the talking point that no Republican supported the bill. And so even Republican colleagues of mine who were involved and wanted to negotiate felt they could not do that. So this is a very different process than what happened then. And it would be wonderful if Republican colleagues like John McCain would say, you know what, I'm not going to participate in this, and let's do exactly what he said before. Let's sit down, let's work together. Instead of ripping health care away from people and raising their costs, let's solve the problems and lower the costs.
There is talk, and we've heard your Democratic colleagues talking about things that could be done within the Senate to fight this bill in terms of slowing things down, or what's being talked about? What things are in the toolkit?
Well, we will use every tool that we have, and that means speaking, that means offering amendments. We will use every tool that we have. Now, they are using a process that has very limited time on the floor when we actually get to the bill. We want to block the bill from coming to the floor so that we can then change the conversation to, again, lowering the cost of prescription drugs and other out-of-pocket costs. So our hope is that we can block it before it comes. But if we cannot, and that's only 51 votes, so we have to have three Republicans. But if not, there's only 10 hours of debate on this particular approach that they're using. They're using a type of process that will only allow 10 hours of votes. And then we can offer amendments, which we will do. We will offer amendments, as many that we can. But in the end, they are in the majority, and in the end, they will be able to get a vote. And so we know that we have to have three Republican colleagues say no to this. And I'm hopeful in states like Ohio and other states that have expanded Medicaid and have had the same kind of positive experience we've had in Michigan, with more people being covered, more seniors having access to nursing home care and actually saving money for taxpayers. We're hopeful that they will vote in the best interests of the people of their states, and that we'll be able to get three votes.
Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow, as always, thank you so much, Senator.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He spent 40 years teaching geography, sociology, and psychology at South Haven High School. He coached football, wrestling, and baseball, and he made it into the Michigan High School Coaches Hall of Fame. But another honor awaits James McLuhan next month. That's when the former Army combat medic will head to the White House, where President Trump will present him with the Congressional Medal of Honor. James McLuhan is being honored for the courage he showed in rescuing and treating his wounded comrades during the fierce Battle of Nuyen Hill in May 1969. James is with us now. Welcome and congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you. And here we are in the great state of Michigan, right?
Indeed, indeed. Take us back to Vietnam, to Nuyen Hill in those 3 days in May 69. What do you remember about the fighting, James?
Well, what I remember is that I had a whole lot of people with me that actually got me through this particular battle. This medal is all about love, and it's a love that's deep in my soul, and it's even hard to measure how deep this love is. 89 of us were combat assaulted by helicopter into this area, and as the 2 days progressed and we lost men in the battle and also heat exhaustion, I realized how important those particular people were to me. And I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you on the phone if we hadn't formed a great team and every man did his job with his particular weapon, or in my particular case, to make sure that I medically took care of my men and also went out and brought them back in so I could revive some of them to get back into the fight and put others into a safe place who had been injured so badly and wounded so badly that they couldn't carry on. So you find out how really deep a love is for one another when you're placed in a situation that not many of us ever will be placed in our lifetime.
Indeed. And you are credited with saving the lives of 10 members of Charlie Company, your company. And you were wounded, right? Not once, but twice.
Yeah, I was wounded the first day and was instructed by the company commander to get on the helicopter as I put the wounded on to be evacuated out. It's called a medevac. And I realized that earlier on when the RPG exploded near me that I remember the pain, and I looked down and noticed my own blood on my body, but nothing was going to keep me from staying there. I knew how badly they were going to need me. I saw from a distance the North Vietnamese coming down off of Nguyen Hill, and they were probably not quite a half mile away from us at that particular point, and there was a lot of them. And we were down to two medics at that time. And so I would rather be dead than to have gotten on that helicopter and found out later on that someone else got killed because their medic wasn't there for them. That was my job. And I intended to carry it out to my death if that's what I had to do.
Did you, once you got home and got back in that classroom at South Haven High School, did you ever share your war experiences or your thoughts about war with your students?
I did not share in depth. As a matter of fact, a lot of them are saying, wow, we never knew. There are certain things about that experience that you don't want to even experience in your mind again, and especially as a combat medic, because I got close to those that were very, very badly wounded, and I don't even describe that to my wife. I did talk about the experience and how I grew from that experience, and I also connected it to how grateful they should be to those who have, are, and will fight for their freedom. So I used it more as a building of character for them and an appreciation for what many, many men and women have done and are doing to preserve this wonderful nation that we live in and the extreme freedom that we have to do many, many, many things that in other countries it doesn't happen.
You know, here you are going to the White House next month, and it'll be the first time President Trump gives someone a Medal of Honor.
Yes, it will.
And if you could, I'm looking at a picture right now of this smiling 23-year-old medic, this young man. If you could talk to that kid who was in the middle of that desperate fighting in May of 69, if you could talk to him right now, what would you say to him?
Keep on doing what you're doing here, because your job is to save these men. So do it to the best of your ability, just like your father told you, and never do anything halfway. That's what he told me, and it was ingrained in me. If I did something as a chore around the house and he didn't think it was done well enough, then I would have to correct whatever it is that I forgot to do. But he did it in a loving way, and he did it in such a way that I am very grateful for having had the father that I had that not only loved me, but loved me enough to make sure that I understood what my responsibilities were and to carry them out.
James McLuhan, the retired South Haven High School teacher, will receive the Congressional Medal of Honor next month at the White House. He will become the 68th living soldier to win the nation's highest military honor for his actions and his courage in Vietnam. James, congratulations, and even more importantly, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you.
School's out. Summer's at hand. Let's help you make some vacation plans. Mission Point Press in Traverse City has your back. They're out with a true insider's guide to Northwest Michigan, Traverse City, the surrounding area, and Leelanau County. It's called Inside Up North. Heather Shaw is here with us. She's lead writer of the new book, along with contributor Jody Taylor. Both of them work for Mission Point Press, and it's a pleasure to welcome you both to Stateside.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for us.
Thank you. Well, Heather, tell me how you wanted this book to be different from the typical travel guide.
The book started with a kind of focus group A bunch of locals got together at Ann Stanton's house. She's part of Mission Point Press as well. And it was a little bit cynical at first. We had stories like how to take a trip south of town to see the bearded lady who sells beef jerky, or how to go visit the Sleeping Bear sand dunes and get rid of your kids. We did keep that last story, but we did jettison more of the cynical stuff. And we just tried to cover all the amazing, diverse things that there are to do in the area besides going to the dune climb in the sand dunes, or Leland's Fish Town, or the Cherry Festival.
The greatest hits that make every list.
Yes.
And it does seem, indeed, that you have something for everyone in here, whether someone has never been to the Traverse and Leelanau area, or if they've been a lot and they think they know all about it. You really have them covered in this book, don't you?
Ann Stanton, again, our partner at Mission Point Press, she says that this is a great book even for locals because every page has something new and exciting. And when you live up here, you tend to get a little lazy about getting out.
So it can motivate people.
Yes.
And Jody, I'm wondering, how long have you lived in Northwest Michigan?
I was born here. So was Heather.
You're a lifer. Heather as well. So this is truly insider information.
It really is. And what that focus group meeting that she talked about was fascinating for me because there were people who were woodsmen, you know, hunters and fishers, and they knew different things than the musician in the group. So all of us coming together brought this plethora of information. And like Heather said, even locals are learning stuff. I didn't know that loons can't walk on land.
Because there's really, besides here's where you can go and find a great meal or get a great view or have a great pint of beer, you also have these great pieces of nature knowledge really coming courtesy of you, Jody Taylor, the Taylor's Encyclopedia of Local Knowledge, like how to find pretty rocks, or I love the how to pee in the woods, because that is an important
thing.
Yeah,
that one was fun. It was a group of friends that we always go camping together, and so we tested different
Yeah, it is truly a lab-tested techniques in here. What is the up north that you've lived in, you know so well, that you want to share with visitors through your book, Heather?
You know, we have 21% of the fresh water in the world here. So that's absolutely astounding. You tell that to somebody who's not from Michigan, and they can't even believe that. Also, Traverse City in particular is a real jewel. It's got this gigantic public waterfront and two tunnels so that you can get back and forth to the beach. And it has, in my humble opinion, the best food north of Chicago. Even Mario Batali thinks we have the best food. He calls it a gastronomic destination. And then you can get outside. We have bike trails that go town to town. You can go from Traverse City up to Leelanau County. The National Lakeshore has recently, I don't know if they've completed it yet, but it's a whole series of trails where you can bike from the dunes to Glen Arbor to Empire to the camping areas. It's just an amazing place.
You've got so much in this book that really is for everyone. Things for kids and teens and singles and adults of all ages and dog lovers and so on. Do you have any idea, like, how many factoids or how many tidbits do you actually have in Inside Up North?
Wow, I don't know.
Every page is packed with things.
Yeah, I think it's upwards of a million.
There you go. Yeah, we talk about roadkill and motorcycles and nude beaches, talking skulls, meteors that burned down Michigan in 1871.
This is not the run-of-the-mill book by a long shot, and I know you have photographs. How did you decide? Because there's just this universe of things to do and see in that Northwest Michigan area. How did you decide what was going to make the book and how to organize it all?
I tried to get everything in there I possibly could. And here's something that I'm the designer as well as a writer and an editor. And I think that there's a big advantage to that because as you're pushing the words around on the page, you can say, oh, I have a little space here. Let's talk about bees, or let's talk about flowers, or let's talk about sandhill cranes. And so there's a big advantage to having a designer who can also write. And we'd like to add something every year and make it kind of like a whole earth catalog that just keeps growing a little bit, like the stories that run across the bottom of the page.
Mm-hmm. And it's designed to be redone every year because I see you've got, for example, this year's summer festivals, concerts, fairs, and sales. But then that way you can kind of take the core of the book and just tweak it every year with the new dates.
That's right. Yes. And we'd like to add things to do up a little bit farther north from us, Charlevoix, Harbor Springs, Petoskey, Mackinac Island. There's lots of good stuff up there. But keeping Traverse City as the hub of everything, you can take day trips. You can make it all the way to Mackinac Island and back in a day.
Indeed. Jody Taylor, I know we're talking to folks who say, oh, I know Traverse. I've been to Leelanau. So give us a few ideas from the book that would surprise the veterans. Maybe that little tidbit that is in there about Michigan's nude beach, for instance.
Well, actually, we all knew about it. And they, when the Park Service came in, they kind of put the skids on it. But there, you can still hide easily. Yeah.
And where is this?
It's at Otter Creek at the National Lakeshore.
Okay. It's, yeah. As you say, probably the best known nude beach in Michigan.
Yeah.
There's a really good place north of Leland. Everybody goes to Leland. They go to Fishtown. That's all they do. But there's a little park just north of Leland called Hodeck Dunes. And it's an amazingly diverse park. And it doesn't have the crowds. Fishtown is a zoo. So you can walk in the dunes, you can walk in these big old forests with these giant birch trees. And last week I walked there and there were hundreds of pink lady slippers. Hundreds! I'd never seen anything like it, and I've lived here my whole life. So we have lots of really cool things like that that you just might miss if you go to the same old spots.
You know, and I was out at Sleeping Bear yesterday, and I stopped in a shop in Glen Arbor, and a woman came up to the shopkeeper and said, how much are the Petoskey stones? And I thought, oh, honey, they're free.
And you even give us a guide on how to find the pretty stones in this.
And we went out right after that and went to Glen Haven right by the cannery, and my son found three within like 5 minutes.
There really is a sense of fun and exploration in Inside Up North, but you've done work that can mean something to a lot of small businesses in Northwest Michigan, the kinds of places, as you say, that might get overlooked for the same old, same old.
Well, Traverse City has always been a bit of an innovator. You know, that 100 years ago, there were no trees here, and even as all those trees were coming down, the lumberman founding father, Perry Hanna, was building his retirement home and looking at that view of the bay that he had created. And so the innovation 100 years ago meant tearing down those sawmills and cleaning up the waterfronts and building hotels. And then 50 years ago, it meant signing over your summer home to create a national park. And a lot of people these days who were born here moved away, learned to do something, and brought it home, like Mike and Denise Busley, who created
Grand Traverse Pie.
Grand Traverse Pies. They learned to bake pies in California, brought it home. It's all over the state. Or the Myers brothers, who went to Europe backpacking and saw kiteboarding and brought it home and stamped it on a T-shirt and created a whole new culture. Or Bob Sutherland, who created Cherry Republic by first selling T-shirts out of the back of his car. Pies, liberty, and
beaches.
Give us a sense, each of you, your perfect up north moment. What's that like?
This is Jody, and I live in southern Grand Traverse County, halfway between the Boardman River and the Manistee River. And my perfect day is to go probably down to the Manistee, and the North Country Trail runs along it. This is south of Fife Lake, north of Cadillac. And so you could walk all the way to North Dakota, I think. I've never done that. But it wends its way along the Manistee River and through the woods, and it's well-maintained, and hardly anybody's on it. And you just get this sense of the water and the old growth and the new growth of all our woods. And each season it's different because, like, the lady slippers, and then you get Indian paintbrush, and then you get the coloring leaves, and then in the winter you can snowshoe. So having that within 15 minutes of my front door is a blessing.
And Heather Shaw, what's your perfect up north moment?
Well, that depends. We get a lot of family coming up here, family and friends, just constantly all summer long. And I have to say that it's really fun just to take the kids and go downtown and go to the splash pad. And then you go to the beach and then you go to the splash pad and then you go downtown and you get some crazy great meal. And then you go back to the beach. And then you get a kayak and you go up and down the Boardman. It's just absolutely perfect. It's quotidian. Everybody can do it. But it's so much fun.
Well, the fun is all inside this new book, Inside Up North, The Complete Tour, Sport, and Country Living Guide to Traverse City, Traverse City Area, Leelanau County. Heather Shaw, Jody Taylor of Mission Point Press. Fun, fun book. Lots of great information. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. President Trump's budget proposal for the new fiscal year continues to send shockwaves through the scientific world. Scientists warn the huge cuts in federal science funding pose a threat to our nation's role as a world leader in scientific research and innovation. At special risk under the Trump budget, basic scientific research, the type that's being done by University of Michigan ecologist Megan Duffy. She's a public engagement fellow with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Megan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What did you think when details started coming out of the president's proposed budget?
I think that I didn't expect it would be amazing for science, but I was still pretty disheartened when I saw the actual numbers. I just saw a study that shows there's actually a lot of support for science if people realize what a small amount of our budget goes towards it. And knowing that it's already a small amount and seeing that it's going to get cut even further was just really disheartening. It really impacts our ability to do science because now I'm spending my summer writing grant proposals instead of doing research in the lab and writing up my results. And so it really impacts our ability to do our science.
And just so we can understand the kind of important work being done by you in basic scientific research, you're focused on a little tiny creature called a Daphnia. What are you studying and why is Daphnia important?
Sure. Daphnia is this funny word that most people haven't heard of, but they're actually very common creatures. So you can think of them as little tiny shrimp that live in our lakes. And they're really important in our lake food web. So they eat algae. So they keep our lakes from looking like pea soup, which we all appreciate. And they're also a really important food resource for fish. So small fish like young bluegill sunfish, they eat Daphnia. So they're really important in our lakes. And so we're interested in understanding Daphnia and what controls their populations just because they're ecologically important. But also we use them to understand infectious diseases. So Daphnia, like basically everything else, gets attacked by parasites. Parasites are everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets infected at some point. And so by using these tiny little creatures that live in lakes, we can understand generally why disease outbreaks occur, what can be done to stop them, what the different factors that influence infectious diseases. And we can do these studies on these Daphnia that live in lakes because they're tiny little crustaceans. And so there aren't ethical or as many logistic challenges to working on them.
And there's work being done in terms of fungal infections?
Yeah. So this is one of the really surprising aspects of this work. We started out doing this research because we were interested in Daphnia, we're interested in their role in lake food webs. But as we did the research, we found some chemical compounds that prevent fungal infections. I mean, just none of the animals got infected when they were exposed to the parasite at the same time that they were exposed to these compounds. So this is, you know, this is good news potentially. And so now we're doing work with some drug discovery labs. So labs where there's a medicinal chemist or someone who's an expert in their labs that do all of their work taking compounds we find out in nature and seeing if they're effective against human pathogens. So we're working with these labs now, and we're screening these against human fungal pathogens and fungal pathogens that influence agricultural crops to see if they're effective against them too. And our hope is we might find a new human medicine.
This is, it strikes me as you describe this, this is almost like coal mining down there chipping away when you're doing this basic science research that maybe doesn't grab the big headlines the way cancer research might or HIV research, but that's all built in people in the coal mines of science kind of chipping away, and suddenly something you never expected is discovered.
Exactly. That's a great summary of basic research. And I spent last week in Washington, D.C., and I went to Capitol Hill. And they said, oh, you work on infectious diseases. And they wanted to talk about NIH, which is the National Institute of Health. And that does a lot of the applied cancer research, infectious disease research.
And you're like, hold up.
And exactly. One of my points was that research is built on a foundation of basic research. And we need that funding for that basic research, or we can't do the research that's more directly, immediately applicable to people.
That grabs the big headline.
That grabs
the big
headline.
So where does your funding come from, Megan?
So my funding is from the National Science Foundation, and they have the mandate to fund basic scientific research.
And what's in line for them in the Trump budget?
Yeah, so NSF often – so NSF mm-hmm. is the National mm-hmm. Science Foundation. They often are overlooked, and in these summaries, you don't even see them because they're such a small portion of the budget. The proposal is to cut their budget, and funding levels are already so low. So the program I apply to, 8% of proposals get funded. And I've been on the proposal review panels, and there are these amazing, really exciting projects where you read it and you say, this might really transform our understanding of how the natural world works. And it doesn't get funded. And so you sit, you read through all these proposals, and some of them are just amazing. And you know that there isn't the funding for that work. And so we're missing out on all these discoveries. And we'll never know what we missed out on, right? Because we didn't do the work.
I wonder how this uncertainty, I mean, it's already you're really fighting hard for every funding dollar you get. How is that uncertainty impacting this younger generation of scientists in your lab?
That's a great question. It definitely impacts them because they wonder, will I be able to have a career? You know, in order to do your science, you need the funding to do your science. And if you have an academic position, you also need to get grants in order to get tenure to keep your academic position. And the next generation of scientists are really being caught in a hard place here where they're expected to get this funding, but the funding isn't there. And so we're starting to see now people who are losing their careers because of the cuts to science funding. And this is just so devastating. They've spent over a decade in training, if you combine their graduate research, their postgraduate training, their years as an assistant professor, and then it's done.
And you think of what's not being discovered that could ultimately make such a difference in the well-being of mankind.
Exactly, right? This work that I mentioned that mm-hmm. we just did in my lab, we never would have thought that by playing around with these Daphnia and mm-hmm. fungi, and, you know, I say playing around, but obviously we had questions that we were addressing, but we did not think that novel human medicines might result from this work. And that's how basic research works. When you work on a question because you think it's interesting for one reason, sometimes you uncover something that opens up this whole new line of research that's really potentially has really important applications.
And you want to make a strong point about what this proposed Trump budget with its deep, deep cuts to science could mean in creating diversity in the next generation of scientists, particularly a couple of important programs that are really going to be slashed or eliminated?
Yeah, so the McNair Scholars Program is going to be eliminated. That's the proposal, at least. And this is a program that does a lot to diversify the next generation of scientists. So it takes people from backgrounds that are underrepresented in the sciences, and it trains them. It prepares them for how do you apply to grad school? How do you get the research experience that you need? And it really launches them into competitive graduate programs. And they're coming from diverse backgrounds, and so they're addressing questions that I wouldn't think to ask, that they're using approaches that I wouldn't think to use. And we know that having this diversity in our groups that are doing science leads to stronger science. And so when we cut programs that foster diversity, scientific innovation is harmed.
So overall, what's the price you think our nation will pay if the president's proposed budget goes through and these things happen to scientific funding?
I think if President Trump's budget goes through, it will just devastate American innovation. Already, France has issued a call that scientists can move there with 4 years of funding. People will start moving. It's not a subtle. This is clear. This will start happening. We will lose really bright scientists. They'll either move to other careers, they'll move to other countries, and we'll lose our status as leaders in the world in scientific innovation. And that would just be tragic.
I'm interested in whether you feel that there are sympathetic ears on Capitol Hill. You said you've been there recently. We know that there was the March for Science in April. You wonder how much of an impact, because then out comes the Trump budget and the axe falls on scientific funding. Do you feel anyone in a powerful position is listening?
I think there are people who are listening. So last week, as I said, I was on the Hill. I met with some staffers from the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And one of them has a PhD in biology. The other has a master's in health administration. They were amazingly supportive of science. And so I think a lot of the people who are working on Capitol Hill do really care about this.
But are the people legislating and the people in power?
Some of them do. So I think our senators here in Michigan mm-hmm. are very supportive of science.
They're in the minority party.
They are in the minority party. Yeah. But I think, as I mentioned right at the start, if people realize how little we spend on science, then they think we should be spending more on this, right? Science funding has an amazing return on investment. And so I think when we start talking to legislators and we point out the jobs that are created, the return on investment that you get from money that you spend on science, I think this is something that both sides of the aisle can really get behind.
What's your call to action to everyone listening to us talk right now?
I think we need to reach out to our legislators and tell them that we support scientific funding, that scientific funding is really important. And that includes funding for the National Institutes of Health, but also for the National Science Foundation. We need our basic scientific research to be done to build the foundation that we use to do all of our other work, like the cancer research.
And the time to call would be now, before that budget gets sealed for the new fiscal year.
Yes. Now is an excellent time to contact your legislators.
University of Michigan ecologist Megan Duffy, who's a public engagement fellow with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
Beards and baseball mixed with roller coasters and religion. That could be a nutshell description of a West Michigan religious society called the House of David. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history. Here with us now from the Michigan History Center, hello to Rachel Clark. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
Rachel, when you research House of David, you find a list of beliefs that include abstinence, a vegetarian diet, no alcohol or tobacco, and that killing for any reason is a sin. So let's start at the very top. Just what is the House of David?
The House of David was and is a religious society that has its beginnings, for the most part, in 1903 in Fostoria, Ohio. It was started by a couple named Benjamin and Mary Purnell. And so they had a belief system that sort of goes with the Book of Revelations, that the end of days is coming, and therefore you should live your life as cleanly and well as possible so that when the end comes, you are prepared.
Fair enough. How did they get to Michigan?
They eventually just moved to Benton Harbor. Apparently, Mary had a vision that Benton Harbor was the place where they needed to be, and they'd never heard of it before, they had stated. So they ended up in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and quickly wound up with quite a few followers.
And they had to leave Fostoria kind of in a cloud, correct? Having to do with the death of one of their children?
It was a little bit. They had a child, a daughter, who died apparently in a fireworks factory explosion, and they refused to go to her funeral. One of the beliefs is that the living should not have anything to do with the dead. So they refused to go to her funeral, and the community thought that that was absolutely horrific. So they encouraged them to leave.
Got it. Read between the lines. So they wind up in Benton Harbor. How long did it take for the group kind of to take root and grow in Michigan?
It was actually very fast. So by 1904, they're in Michigan. And by the teens, they have quite a following. And then they start to really sort of embrace the community and reach out to the community. And that's when you start to see some of the groups, the baseball team, and eventually the amusement park and bands. So it's pretty fast. You have people who believe that if the end of the world is coming, they need to be part of the group that's going to be saved.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about this colony that the House of David had. You touched on this. So this wasn't just some living quarters and a chapel. Tell us more about what they had.
It was a full community. They had hundreds and hundreds, if not more, of acres of land that they farmed. They had their own lumber mill. They had their own machine shop, hospital, bakeries, shops. They really were a self-sufficient community. They also had land up on an island in Lake Michigan where they also farmed, and they actually lumbered or timbered that land to make some money. So they were very self-sufficient, and it was quite large.
I think I remember hearing they even had their own electricity plant. That
yes.
is extremely self-sufficient. And where did the baseball come in?
Part of their role, they felt their role in society was to get out and to spread the word. And they also were kind of fun. I mean, people who remember them said that they were really nice people and they were fun. So they started a baseball team. One of Purnell's beliefs was that salvation comes through exercise, physical activity, and it helps your spiritual discipline. So baseball just sort of fit with the times. And so they started a team and they were quite good. They competed with semi-pro and stories are even pro teams and traveled all over the country to rural America to raise money for the society, but also to sort of spread the word.
Yeah, I understand that they played Negro League teams as well. So they played everybody.
They did. Anyone that wanted to play, they'd play.
How long did they barnstorm around the country?
For about 30 years. I mean, from the 20s until about the 50s, they continued to play. They eventually even had a basketball team that was sort of a Globetrotters type team. But the baseball team itself traveled around for nearly 30 years.
Things did take somewhat of a darker turn for the House of David when, about the 1920s, with some salacious accusations made against Benjamin Purnell.
Yes, he, in the mid-20s, was accused by upward of 13 women of sexual abuse and just inappropriate behaviors. So that was investigated, and eventually the Attorney General started investigating some of the financial dealings of the society. And in 1927, he was found guilty of fraud. He died a month later, but in the meantime, the society appealed to the Supreme Court to have that overturned. And the conviction was overturned, but it was after Purnell's death.
And what happened to the society after his death?
Once the conviction was overturned and they had their assets back, the society split essentially into two groups. You have the original House of David, which remained in the commune, and then Mary Purnell actually split off and created Mary's City of David up the road. And both societies actually remained pretty successful. They still had the baseball team. That's when the basketball team starts to come in. They still are involved in the community. They still are farming. But eventually, over time, due to some of the beliefs of the group, including no sex, even if you're married, their numbers start to just fall down. But those two individual groups continue for another few years until Mary's death in the early 1950s.
Now, you use the term was and is. So does the House of David still exist in some form today?
There are a few members left, not many. Most of them are still down in Benton Harbor. They still farm. They sell blueberries. They own some properties, so they rent the properties out. So there are still a few members left, but they're nowhere near what they originally were.
But I will imagine that people listening may remember they had the zoo and the amusement park in Benton Harbor, right? Tell us a little about that.
Absolutely. They had this huge sort of entertainment aspect to them. So they had a zoo with a bunch of different animals. They had an amusement park that had a train that was running through it, very much like other small zoos in the state where you can ride a train and see all the different animals. They also had some vacation spots for people to come and just relax in the Benton Harbor area. You know, it's not very far from Chicago.
Right.
And
right.
So coming just down and around the lake into Benton Harbor was a very easy trek for people from Chicago. So they really did have a lot of sort of entertaining aspects to them.
Absolutely fascinating. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, thank you so much for sharing this really intriguing piece of Michigan history with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Claire Bryan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.